Hello, and welcome to Living with Dying, the podcast where we try to break the taboos around death and dying and learn to talk about it. Thank you if you've been listening since the beginning, and if you have, you'll know we've covered so many aspects of death and dying, from what it's actually like to die, to how it feels to lose your nearest and dearest, the different ways grief can strike, the different ways we cope or don't with loss, how counselling can help, what part faith can play, how to help others going through grief, and how to pick up the pieces and rebuild a life after a big loss. Well, I'm here today in Taplow Court to meet with Robert Harrop, who is co-chair of SGI Europe, and Taplow Court is the UK base of SGI.
Yes, that's right.
So, Robert, lovely to meet you. I want to hear all about the Buddhist faith from you, but what got you into it in the first place? Can we start with that?
Of course. I've been a Buddhist for nearly 40 years, and I started when I was in my early 20s after a motorbike accident. The effect on me was that I smashed my right leg very badly, and the doctor said it would be a long time before I'd recover. I knew I would recover, but it just was going to be a long time. And I just was very cross with life because this thing had happened to me, and all my friends seemed to be off doing exciting and interesting things. And I felt very imprisoned by my situation. And in the middle of that period, somebody suggested that I try some Buddhist chanting. And my response was quite cynical. How on earth is that going to make a difference? And this lady said, well, try it. It might make you feel different. And that was really interesting because I know that looking back, I wanted to feel different. I didn't want to feel imprisoned by the situation. She showed me the chanting meditation, which is what we do in SGI. There's a phrase, the phrase is Nam-myoho Renge Kyo, and that's repeating that phrase is the key part of the Buddhist practice. Anyway, she showed me how to do it, and she gave me some things to read, and I went away and I was fascinated by what I read, and I was trying to chant on my own in my bedroom, and I realized that I was starting to feel different. So I had lots more questions. I went back to her and she introduced me to someone who lived nearer to where I was. I was down in Devon at the time. And I was waiting for my questions not to be answered, but actually I got some very interesting answers about Buddhist philosophy and how it could be a useful, practical philosophy of life.
Can you explain the difference in how you felt before and how you felt after? So what it actually did for you?
Well, I suppose the main difference was that I was frustrated because, A, the accident had happened because it had come out of the blue. And also as a result of it, I wasn't able to do the things that my mates were doing. So that was there was a frustration of that. And I suppose my perspective about the accident changed. I realised it could have been a lot worse. It was bad enough to smash my leg. Actually, you know, it could have been worse. I could have died, or I could have lost my leg. So there was a deeper realisation about what could have happened, and also I started to think, well, how have I been living since I left school after A levels? What have I been doing with my life? What has my ambition been? And I realised that I could have a different and deeper and more creative ambition. And that's been the sort of the unfolding of my life ever since.
Just an interjection here. What you've described does sound a bit similar to counselling and therapy, which helps people have a different perspective, doesn't it? Was there a sort of an element of that going on, do you think, in your talking to people?
I don't think that would have been it wasn't in my mind, and it probably wasn't in the mind of the people I was exploring it with. But no, I think a lot of those things, you know, whether it's life coaching or counselling or therapy, I think actually they have drawn a lot on different Eastern philosophies and perspectives to create something which is helpful in the modern age. So I see when I look at a lot of things like that. I realize that there definitely is a resonance with what Buddhism's been teaching for thousands of years.
But it's obviously, it was really powerful in that it helped you.
Definitely. Yeah. Yes. So in terms of the physical condition, there wasn't a miraculous cure or anything like that. But it, you know, I learned to be patient with the healing process. When I was convalescing, I was living at home with my mother and stepfather, who were both Christians, and they were just pleased that I'd found a faith that was working for me, and they were very supportive. I think it was a very useful experience to have seen how both the Buddhist practice and philosophy were. I could apply them in my life at that point, and then there have been other opportunities as well as the years have gone on to see how it works in daily life.
And obviously I'm here to find out what the Buddha's view of death and dying is. But I think before we get into that, we need to know, what does SGI stand for, seeing as you've mentioned it a couple of times?
Sure. So the letters SGI stand for Soka Gakkai International. Soka Gakkai are two Japanese words, and Gakkai means society or association. And Soka has absolutely nothing to do with football at all, but it translates as value creating. So it's the value creating society. And value really means, how can human beings create the most value in their lives? Not necessarily in an economic sense, but much more about qualities of compassion and empathy, but courage and wisdom, and so that everyone can fulfill their potential as a human being. What's really interesting about the question of death for a Buddhist is that Buddhism started with a young man whose name was Siddhartha Gautama, he's often described as a royal prince. There's a bit of a question mark about whether it's strictly factually correct, but he came from a comfortable and wealthy family. But most sort of early texts refer to him as a royal prince. And he had a very, very comfortable life. He lived in a palace. His father wanted him to be his successor. And he had everything he could possibly wish for. He had a wife. He was having children. But on four occasions, he left the royal palace and he realized something about the suffering that is in life. So they're often called the four meetings or four encounters. And so on one occasion, he saw someone who was old and suffering as a result of aging. On the second one, he saw someone who was sick and who was suffering as a result of illness. On the third one, he saw a corpse and saw people suffering because of grief, and also realizing that, of course, everybody is going to die. And then the fourth meeting was he saw a holy man. As a result of that, he decided that he didn't want to stay in the comfortable palace. He wanted to go out and resolve the question of human suffering. So it was his seeking spirit to know, why do we suffer because of old age, sickness and death? And then he went on a journey to inquire into what is available in a religious or a spiritual sense to answer those questions. And he tried various practices that were there. He didn't find them satisfactory to answer the question. So he decided that he was going to resolve the question by looking into his own life, by a consideration and a contemplation of his own consciousness, his own mind. And so he famously sat under a tree deep in meditation until he found the answer. So that process of deep contemplation led him to recognize that he had within his own life the resources to transform the experience of old age, sickness and death into to a different perspective. So these are things that are part of life, but it's not necessary for them to be automatically be a cause for pain and suffering and a negative view. So what he saw through that process was that there is a rhythm of life. I think when most human beings think about life and death, it's quite natural for us to think about this lifetime, starting with conception and the gestation period of an embryo, and then of course we celebrate our birthday, and then we can see through infancy, childhood, going through the teenage years, maturity, that period of maturity, and then as we get older, our hair goes grey, things happen to our bodies, and then we're probably more prone to illness, and then life ends with death. And so we see life as a lifespan, starting conception and birth and going to hopefully 3 score years and 10 or something like that, to be the life that that's what we think of as life. And then we think of life as coming to an end and then death. And one of the things that the Buddha realized and taught very much as an early teaching was the whole idea of impermanence, of the fact that this body is going to come to an end. But what he taught was what's coming to an end is this physical body, but life is much more than a physical body. And he taught about a rhythm of life, a cycle of life. So the idea that before conception, the thing that becomes us, there's a spiritual energy that was out there somewhere in the universe, and that at the point of conception takes on a physical form, and that becomes the embryo, that becomes the infant and the child and the growing and maturing human being. And that at the point of death, whether it's by an accident or an illness or old age, that's the thing that comes to an end, but the spiritual energy continues on. So he was his teaching about impermanence was to get people to recognize that yes, this body will come to an end, but because we're much more than that physical body, there will be something that will continue. And so, in my shorthand, when I'm thinking about this, it's that I write the word life with a capital L. Life is made up of a lifetime and then a period of death, followed by a lifetime and another period of death. So it's life with a capital L equals life and death. And as a cycle that will continue on. And then, of course, it's always an analogy, and analogies are inherently imperfect. But the same rhythm, we see it in a kind of, if we look at a week, how we operate in a week, we're going to have 7 days where we will be active and moving around and doing whatever it is we need to do. But at the end of each day, we're going to have a period where we rest and we go to sleep to recharge our batteries. So the analogy is that in the same way that we need to sleep in order to have an active day tomorrow, we need death in order to have an active life at the point where this lifetime has come to an end. And then when we see life through that lens, then death is still sad because of the loss of losing someone, but there's a hope in it because it's a temporary thing in terms of it's just the end of that particular lifetime. There'll be a period where that person's spiritual energy has the opportunity to recharge. And then at an appropriate time, very difficult to calculate or anticipate, but there will be, in this rhythm of life, there will be the opportunity for that person to come back and have a new physical form and another experience of being alive.
And that's what we call reincarnation, coming back as an animal or ant or something, is it or not?
Well, yeah, and I think there's quite a big philosophical debate about whether it's reincarnation or transmutation or whatever it is. But a reincarnation sort of tends, I think, to imply that you come back as yourself again. Now, I have no memory of previous lives, so I subscribe to this view of a cycle of life, but I don't remember when what I was in previous lifetimes. And some people, might have some inkling or some strong feeling of what they were, but I certainly don't. So, and I think the Buddha taught, he said, well, when this body comes to an end and the spiritual energy continues, he was quite precise about what he meant by that. So, there's a description of different levels of consciousness. So the ones that are near the surface, that are to deal with our senses, how we perceive the world through our sight, our smell, our hearing, our taste and touch, those are levels of consciousness that go with the body. Once the body goes, those aspects of life, they also cease. But there are the kind of the deepest memory. I'm sure you're familiar with the word karma. It's that deepest aspect of the causes and that we've created and the tendencies that we might have in our life. That, together with our purest and most enlightened potential, which a Buddhist practice is about trying to find that and draw it out, it's karma and that Buddha potential that we all have. It's that which will continue on in the into the merge into the with the universe and continue.
So does this mean that you, as Buddhists, celebrate death?
Well, we held funerals, and I think the distinction between a Buddhist funeral and those that I've attended in other situations is that we really see them as a celebration of life. And it is an interesting mixture because there is grieving, because it's often quite soon after the moment that somebody has passed away. That's definitely there. But at the same time, we're really looking at, well, this person, they made a wonderful contribution, not only to our community but in their own personal life and with their friends and family and their work. So we really look to make a have a celebration of that. And yeah, to recognize that this perspective of the rhythm of life is so important that their life needs now to have this period of rest. I mean, I use the analogy of being awake and being asleep. Another analogy is of the if the kind of the universal energy is like the ocean, then out of the ocean, individual waves appear. And they for a short period of time you can distinguish a wave followed by a different wave. And so our lifespan is like a wave of that energy coming out as an individual wave. But then there's a point where it merges with the ocean and rejoins the larger body of water. And so we try and think of that period of being alive as it's temporary. Hopefully it's as long as necessary for us to do amazing things with our life, but there will come a time when it comes to an end, and there will be loss and there will be grief as a result of that. But the amazing thing is that that person's spiritual energy is rejoining the merging with the universal whole.
So does that mean you personally don't dread death?
I don't want it to happen today or tomorrow. We can't prophesy when it's going to happen. So I don't know, I don't dread it, but I want it to happen at the right moment. I mean, one of the things I was thinking about was when I knew I was going to speak with you was of people who I'm aware of who've died in different circumstances. And there was a wonderful friend who passed away some years ago, who was one of the pioneers of SGI in the UK, who had a diagnosis of cancer, and it became apparent it was incurable. And her attitude to her death was absolutely extraordinary. It was a complete acceptance of the fact that this lifetime was coming to an end, and that it was the most exciting and wonderful journey was about to unfold before her, and she was completely ready for the process of dying, and looking forward to what was going to come on that journey. I was asked to be involved in the preparations for her funeral. We had an extraordinary experience of sitting around her bed as we planned and programmed her funeral, and I can remember crying with laughter about what she was doing. Her main concern was that she knew that she was going to leave her husband, and that the big concern was that it was his grief and how he would respond as a result. But I was so impressed by her attitude to it, and I thought that's I want to do my best to have to share that attitude of this is part of an exciting journey.
But what about her husband? Was he also of the same faith? Did he?
Yes. It was difficult for him, yes, and she was right. She wanted to make sure that he had support in place, and she was absolutely. That was the wise approach. It was difficult, yes, but I think the Buddhist view of grieving is again very helpful. There's a story about the Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, who was approached by a young mother who came holding a dead baby and asking the Buddha for help. And the Buddha said, "I can help you. I want you to go into the village or go into the town. I want you to find me a mustard seed from a home where they have never known death." And so this desperate woman ran in, and she was ran from house to house to house, and asked if they had a mustard, asked if they'd ever known death, and could they, if they hadn't, could she have a mustard seed? And what she realized was that there isn't a home that hasn't known death. And so the help the Buddha gave her was to help her to recognize that this is part of the process. I don't, not sure what you think of that story, but personally, I find it, I think it's, you know, to put someone on a path of recognizing that as awful and as tragic as it is, there is a possibility of seeing it from a different perspective. The Buddha was also very good at sitting with people in the rain, and that's a phrase that comes from various Buddhist teachings of sometimes it's really difficult to have the words to know what to say to someone who's grieving, but and he had the wisdom to know what was necessary for the particular person he was dealing with at the time, but to say sometimes something, but also on other occasions not to say anything, but just to sit with people in the rain and be with them, beside them, as they were going through whatever it was that they were facing.
So, have you drawn on that experience with people that you've known who've lost others?
Yes, I've tried to. Yes. I think it's sometimes we, I suppose it depends how well we know someone, but yes, sometimes it's just been a question of sitting and either actually holding their hand or sitting near them and being with them. I mean, I think the other thing about our daily practice, so we have a chant, this chanting practice, which I described a little bit at the beginning, and it's there's a simple ceremony. We read two passages from a teaching called the Lotus Sutra, and then we chant the phrase Nam-myoho-renge-kyo, and then the ceremony, which lasts as long as you, the reading of the sutra passages takes about 5 minutes. But the rest of the chanting is down to the individual. If you're in a hurry, you can do 5 minutes, or if you've got more time, you can chant for as long or as little as you like. But then it ends with some silent prayers, and the last of the silent prayers is for the people that we've lost, and we ring the bell as we think of the names of the people that we are, you know, we still have them in, we still bear them in mind. And I think that's also a lovely aspect. So because we chant twice a day, this ceremony is taking place in the morning and the evening. And so I'm thinking of my, both my parents have died, and I'm thinking of them. And particularly when my mother died, because she died, she was 79, not a bad age, but the women in her side of the family usually get to their 90s or even 100. There were some cousins of my grandmother got to 103 and 105. So I think we thought my mother was going to live longer, but she died of cancer. And I mean, I still, she died 18 years ago now, and every day when I'm thinking of her and ringing the bell as I do that ceremony, twice daily ceremony, I'm remembering her. I'm sending her my love, and I. But I just. I also. I feel her love. I kind of that thing of, she's merged like the wave rejoining the ocean that I talked about a moment ago. I can. I feel from that ocean. I'm feeling my mother's love as I'm thinking of her. So it's incredibly useful to have that daily, twice daily ritual, which connects us to those people that we've lost.
That actually makes you think of them.
Yeah.
Tell me a bit about rituals that are involved in a funeral. Do you go to the local crematorium or do you do everything yourselves in your own places? Well, how does that work?
So Usually, a funeral is a cremation. And I think that's probably because of what the intention is to understand that although this life of this body has come to an end, the spiritual energy is continuing. So it would be a little counterintuitive to put too much emphasis on the body. However, I am aware of some people who've chosen to have a burial, and that's been their personal choice. So there's no injunction to do that. So the ceremony is quite, in a way, it's very similar. We do the chanting that we would do in our own daily practice. So the word we use is for that ceremony is gongyo. That's a Japanese word, and it means sort of daily or regular practice. And there are two passages from the Lotus Sutra. That takes about 5 minutes. Then we chant the phrase Nam-myoho-renge-kyo, which is in a way it's the repetitive part, but is the most dynamic part as well, and the silent prayers. So that would be part of a funeral service. Sometimes people there is a ceremonial kind of incense, which sometimes is used, and that's quite it. It's often has the perfume of sandalwood. It's quite smoky, that's sprinkled as people are as we're doing the chanting, usually around the committal, at the point where either curtains come around the coffin or the coffin goes off to the next stage, and then we have the opportunity for people to share things, and whether that's friends or family or whatever, whoever's getting prepared to give a eulogy, and we put emphasis on it being a celebration of their life. And then there's the Buddhist address, which again gives the Buddhist point of view, and the key points of it are, of course, all of us are here because we have a connection with this person, and of course we're feeling sad at the loss, but let's look at the situation through the Buddhist lens, and that there is a rhythm of life, and that their life will continue, and then some quotes from Buddhist scripture, which reinforce that. And I have to say that they're a very hopeful and positive event. And yeah, it's not without tears, but very, very much from a positive and hopeful perspective.
And because of this sort of continuum that you describe, really, sort of Buddhist continuum, does that mean, do you think that grief is less amongst the Buddhist community? Can it be?
I would like to think, and I've looked into, the stages of grieving and that sort of thing, and I've seen that, I've seen the anger, I've seen the frustration and the other elements of it. But I'd like to think that while that unfolds, it's unfolding at a quicker pace because of what Buddhism teaches us about that process. I mean, I've lost friends and family members, and I've always thought, while I've been a Buddhist, I've been very grateful for my Buddhist practice from three angles. One is the practice. I've got something I can do. Chanting is a physical thing. Yes, it's prayer, but it's also you're sitting down, you're making a noise. If I'm cross or angry or upset, then that can come out in my voice as I'm chanting. But then that emotion will subside, and then it will help me to purify what's going on internally. So I'm grateful for the Buddhist practice. I'm grateful for the philosophy, which explains this idea of a cycle of life and a rhythm of life. And I'm also very grateful for the Buddhist community, which means some people who are incredibly supportive. Some are close friends, but some are maybe not close friends, but they're people who I appreciate their support, through being there. So the practice, the philosophy, and the community have been incredibly useful when at the points where I have had an experience of grieving. But one of the things I've really been aware is that grief can be very different for other people, and I've learned to recognize that, and so one can't make assumptions about how other people are going to grieve.
You did say before we even started talking together that there were different kinds of Buddhism and that a lot of the things you were going to say would be different in other branches of Buddhism. Is there anything screaming out at you that you feel you ought to point out about other ways other people would do things?
Well, the main thing is that I'm saying that I may not know the detail, but that there are different ways that the Buddhist ideas are put into practice in different traditions. And I think probably the most famous example is that there's a book that, I don't know, listeners to this podcast may have on their bookshelves, but the Tibetan Book of Living and Dying, or the Tibetan Book of the Dead, there's a penguin version of it, and it describes in great detail the journey of the spiritual energy after death. And in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, of course, the idea of reincarnation, not least the Dalai Lama, but of all of us, it is set out in that text. So I've looked at it. It's the tradition, the Nichiren tradition that I practice, doesn't subscribe to all of those points, but it's another expression of the cycle of life, but through something that's developed through as Tibetan Buddhism developed. So, I mean, there's one phrase which is incredibly useful. So the founder of this particular Buddhist tradition that we practice in the SGI, Nichiren, who lived in the 13th century in Japan, was a very prolific writer and a very poetic writer. And encouraging someone, he talked about the seasons. And he said, winter always turns to spring. And that phrase, winter always turns to spring, is something which is very applicable in challenging circumstances, whether it could be a conflict at work or a grieving situation. But to remind someone that you might feel that you're in a very wintry situation right now, but this will change. Your experience of the emotions that you're feeling now, that will change, and your Buddhist practice, philosophy and support will help that process. It's a very hopeful way of recognizing that as tough as it is now, spring will come, and therefore you can be hopeful about that.
Robert Harrop, thank you very much for talking to me.
Thank you, Dennis.
Death is never easy, but there are ways we can help each other through it. And if you've found any of these episodes helpful, please think about liking and sharing. And if you can help spread the word by telling just one other person, thank you. And a huge thanks to Joe Barrett, without whom these podcasts would simply not be possible. You can contact us on hello@livingwithdying.co.uk.